Before we get to the reason we're all here, which is Roy Dolan, I'll just say a brief word on the Wingate Group. Wingate was established about a decade ago, and we've established ourselves over that past decade as one of Australia's leading mid-sized finance and investment houses. We have a deep relationship with our investor base, which has developed over time, and we've provided them with some pretty good returns over that time as well. We invest in a number of different asset classes. We have a property finance arm. We look at global asset management, private equity, and asset finance as well. If you want any more information about Wingate or what we do, and some of the individuals within the organisation, please speak to me after the talk, or you can run my email address, and we can get started and start investing. Roy Dolan, I actually heard him the other night on Sunday night, and I'm back here again, so it's definitely worth hearing. He's the co-author of the international bestseller The Sistine Secrets, Michelangelo's Forbidden Messages in the Heart of the Vatican. The Sistine Secrets has become a bestseller for art history and the Renaissance in over 26 countries and been translated into 15 languages. He's well studied and knows foreign languages, art history, religious history, Western civilization, architectural history, theatre and film. And he is the first religious Jew to be officially recognised by the Vatican and to undertake tours in the Vatican. And his recommendation was received from the government for his work in popularising the Italian art history. And something closer to home is also actually making Aliyah in the next few months as well. So he'll be dual or triple citizen, right? US, Italian, Israeli.
I'll be ruining people's sleep in at least three more countries at this point.
Very good. So without further ado, the way today's presentation will work is Roy will present for about half an hour, then we'll leave it open for questions for about 10 to 15 minutes, and we'll finish off with Mincha at about 1:45. So without further ado, Roy.
Thank you. Thank you, folks, for inviting me, and thanks for coming. We always, in Italy, at least it's my personal practice, you have to start off with a joke. So since we're talking about business usually here, I figured I would tell you a very popular current joke from Rome. There are entire joke books of just Italian Jewish humor. This is what we do at night. We have dinner, bring out the wine, bring out the dessert, and then the jokes start flying around the table. Same thing happens in the Vatican as well. Anyway, this is on Via Nazionale, the main street in Rome. There's a lot of clothing shops. Can everybody hear me all right?
Yeah.
If not, you're not missing anything. There's all the clothing shops, and about 90% of all the clothing and accessory stores in Rome are Jewish owned. We say you can't buy a tie on Yom Kippur in Rome. There's two clothing shops. One is a Jewish clothing salesman, and the other is his very dear friend, a Catholic clothing salesman. And they're right across the street from each other. They have coffee every morning before they open the shops, etc. And the Catholic clothing salesman sees his Jewish friend is having a lot more business, a lot more clientele, a lot more sales. And he watches and watches. He can't figure out what the secret is. And then he notices that a lot of the clients, when they're going into the Jewish-owned clothing store, touch something slanted on the doorpost and kiss their fingers and then go in. So he thinks that's going to be the key to improving his sales. So he goes and asks his Jewish friend, he says, well, that's a mezuzah, that's all it is. No, it's nothing to do with sales strategy. And he says, yeah, but I want one too. He says, no, that's for a Jewish business or a Jewish home. You don't need that. And, no, I want one too, I want. And he nudges him, pushes and pushes for a month. And finally, his friend can't take it any longer. One day, they go for coffee, and under the counter of the coffee bar, he's got a mezuzah wrapped up in a tissue. He says, here, take it. Don't tell anybody I gave it to you. Don't mention my name here. Just don't bother me about this anymore. Take it and put it up. So his Catholic friend takes it, puts it up on the doorpost, and soon enough, he gets more and more business. Everybody came in, kissing the missus and going in. After a month, they go out for coffee again in the morning, and the Catholic clothing salesman says, here, here, take this thing back. I never want to see it again. He says, what do you mean? You nudged me all this time. You wanted this, and I gave it, and you're giving it back after only a month? He says, yeah, I don't want it. Please take it away. He says, what's the matter? Didn't it help your sales? He says, are you kidding? My sales doubled. It was amazing. But I don't want to. Please take it away. He says, what's the problem? He says, every day, all day long, they're knocking on the door. United Jewish Appeal, Jewish National Fund. Everybody wants charity. So anyway, this is what happens in Rome. Now, this coexistence of Jew and Catholic, Jew and Gentile, is throughout the entire history of Rome, even before Rome was Rome. After the success of my book on Michelangelo, thank God, I started doing more research. I had already done research for many, many years. And this is the book I always wanted to write and didn't know if I should write it. And finally, it just wrote itself about 2 years ago. It came out in Italian, and thank God it's in its umpteenth edition in Italy. The university students wrote to Rizzoli, the publisher, and begged them to have it come out in a scholastic paperback edition because they all wanted it. And I found hidden messages, like Michelangelo's messages in the Sistine Chapel. I found that he's not the only one, that people have been hiding messages in Italian art and architecture, even in food, in the language, everything, for over 2,000 years. So it developed into a book. Now, when I wrote to Rizzoli with the book proposal, they said, so you're going to go region by region. I said, no, I'm not going to organize the book north to south, region by region. They said, so you're going to go chronologically, Roman Republic, Empire, Middle Ages, Renaissance, etc. I said, no. They said, how are you structuring the book? I said, the Eitz Chaim from the Kabbalah, the Tree of Life with the 10 Sphirot, the 10 spheres from the Kabbalah. And they said, you got to be kidding. Then they read the book. They said, we're going to do it. They thought it would look like a crackpot thing, but when they read the book, they said, this makes perfect sense. So it's the first book published by the number one publisher in all of Italy, following the pathway of the 10 spheres on the Tree of Life of the Kabbalah. I'm just going to move myself out of the way. And it's on Amazon. They have the English version with great illustrations. In some countries, it downloads onto Kindle and app. In some countries, the link doesn't work. You'll let me know. Hopefully, this year will come out in hard copy as well. Now, okay. I don't know what happened when we put that slide in, but there we go. Okay. This was the Sistine Secrets. It's in its, I think, 14th or 15th edition in Italy. Rizzoli has it permanently in the catalog, and they said the Jewish Secrets inside the Sistine Chapel is one of the bestsellers of all time for a nonfiction book written by a non-Italian in Italy. So it's a Kiddush Hashem, as we say in Hebrew. That translates into meaning one point for God. Okay, so after that, I was commissioned to write a book about all the secrets of Caravaggio, the great artist a century after Michelangelo. And then this happened to me. This adventure started about 5 years ago. I was brought in on a special case of a mysterious terracotta that had been found in a private collection. And all the top art historians had been brought in on it, and nobody could figure out who made it or why. And the only thing they knew, it was from the end of the 1400s, and it was an amazing masterpiece. And I was brought in, and I told the owner of the statue, I said, if you let me apply the forensic procedure from the Talmud, from the tractate Bava Metzia, which is sort of like a kosher version of Sherlock Holmes, if you let me apply that, I can solve the mystery. And he let me do it, and it's now completely confirmed by all the top experts on Michelangelo and on Renaissance history. This is the model that Michelangelo made to win the commission to make the world-famous Pietà statue in the Vatican. The owner of the statue really likes me now. Because the value went from a few thousand euros. I spoke with the head of Sotheby's about this. He wanted to see me about this. He told me if they auctioned it, the opening bid would be 300 million euros. Yeah. Owner really likes me. Now, he also wants to read the Talmud now. And so do all the other art historians. It's being unveiled in a special exhibition next month in Paris in a very important museum, and then it goes on a world tour. So my speeches here in, my lectures here in Melbourne, this is my last series of lectures on a lot of different things. For the next year or so, I'm going to be babysitting this statue around the world, wherever it goes. I want to bring it here as well to Melbourne. They gave me a beautiful private tour of the National Gallery, and they even showed me the rooms that they offer to do the exhibition in. So maybe this will come here. Anyway, the Discovery Channel did a huge documentary on all of these secrets of Michelangelo. It comes out here in Australia in November, so I hope you get to see it. I don't know where this photo was. They had me speak in a lot of places, but don't tell Obama I stole his lecture stand. Anyway, here we come to the structure of the book, The Tree of Life. This is one of the earliest forms of the study of the Kabbalah. Now, I'm not talking about Madonna's Kabbalah. She and I talked 2 hours about Kabbalah, and hopefully she has a better conception of what it is now. She's very serious about her studies, very, very motivated, but they were giving her sort of Southern California Kabbalah. Anyway, the Kabbalah starts, the Tree of Life starts with Malchut. Malchut is empire, and it's the material world. It's very easy to remember the M for Malchut. You can think of material. And what Judaism tries to do, our goal, is to spiritualize, transform the world, make it transcend itself. In other words, we take things material, like food, and we elevate it into a spiritual meaning and a spiritual practice. And that's all it is. So we've got the material world here, and the rest of the Tree of Life tries to lift it up into the spiritual. Now, what does this have to do with Italy and Rome? Well, this will give us a clue. This is inside the world-famous temple by one of the worst enemies of the Jewish people, Hadrian, in Hebrew and Latin, Hadrianus. He was one of the biggest mass murderers in the ancient world, but he was also a brilliant architect. This is the last man standing. This is the last intact Roman temple in the entire world. It's amazing. When I take architectural classes and postgraduate classes here, we can spend literally the entire day about all the engineering and architectural secrets in this incredible building. But what most people do not know is even the floor has meaning. In Italy and in art and architecture, everything has hidden meanings. I just had a wonderful tour with a guide here in Melbourne who explained the hidden meanings of the Eureka building and of the museum over here. And all, everything that an architect or an artist does is going to have several layers of meaning. Now, the Gentile architects and engineers and artists in Italy, if they came through Florence in the end of the 1400s, early 1500s, they had been exposed to Talmud and Kabbalah, which teaches you to see the world, perceive the universe on several different layers of meaning simultaneously. And they said, that is going to enrich the meaning and the impact and the feeling of my work, be it a building or a statue or a fresco or a painting. And here, even in the ancient world, Hadrian had studied a little bit of Judaism before he went stark raving mad. I hope studying Judaism didn't make him go stark raving mad. Anyway, this is his floor of the Pantheon. Now, this here is not just a pretty design. This has deep meaning. Unfortunately, the colors are a little bit off, but it's not so bad here. This is actually royal purple marble. This comes from one of the two previous superpowers before Rome took over the whole Mediterranean area, Egypt. And this stone is incredibly precious. We could talk an hour just about this stone. It's called porphyry in English, porfido in Italian. And surrounding it is from the other previous superpower in the world, Greece. And that is Antico Giallo, ancient yellow marble. And Rome wanted to show off it had surpassed and beaten down the two previous superpowers in the world, Egypt and Greece. So this became the symbol of the city of Rome. To this very day, it's called the Giallorosso. The soccer team wears these two colors. The taxis have these two colors. The flag over City Hall has these two colors, the symbol of Rome for having conquered the Malchut of Greece and the Malchut of Egypt. Now, this also symbolizes Malchut, the material world, and the spiritual world for pagan Rome. The round part is the spiritual world. The square part is the material world. Which one is surrounding the other? Which one is dominating the other world? Which is the dominant of the two worlds?
Square.
What?
The square.
The square, thank you. The square, the material world is far more important. The material world is the square. This is where we get the expression, both in English and in Hebrew, the four corners of the world. Now, the spiritual, that's after you're dead. The idea in pagan Rome was do what you like, do what feels good, do what enriches you. Ethics, spirituality, doesn't matter. After you're dead, think about that. And this is the exact opposite of Judaism and then later on Christianity. This is why pagan Rome tried to suppress both the Jews and the Christians. Now, this is another symbol of Malchut. After Rome destroyed Israel, Jerusalem, and the Holy Temple, the punishment for the surviving Jews, 90,000 were taken in chains as slaves to Rome and had to build this. The Colosseum is entirely Jewish slave labor, and the finances to pay for constructing this enormous structure was all the gold taken out of the treasury of the Holy Temple. So it was a double whack in the head to the Jewish people. Now, there's a very little known fact, and this will give us a real concept of the world of Malchut of ancient Rome. Somebody cheated the emperors, Vespasian and Titus, when they built this. The contract called for all of these blocks to have bronze braces inside them. It really looks like a giant Lego set. This is the world's first snap-together building. It's the first structure made of stone and metal together. Every huge marble block had at least four bronze pegs embedded in the top of each block, and then the block put on top had four holes so it would actually snap together. So if the land shook from a tremor or settled or shifted, or this is also the heaviest building in the ancient world of Rome, put on very soft wet soil. So this is what was going to keep it up forever. They cheated them. They pocketed the money to put in very expensive bronze rods and instead put in the cheapest, lowest quality iron rods in about half of the building. So when there was an earthquake centuries later, the iron parts had rusted completely and snapped like toothpicks. The bronze held. In the Middle Ages, people gouged holes to pull out the bronze. You can still see places where they'll spend a whole day 1,000 years ago gouging into the marble, and then they arrive at a rusty iron peg. They're so disgusted they just leave it there. So this is a metaphor of life in Rome and life in the material world today. If you want to pull out what you want without caring for the whole structure, if you want to cheat the society to enrich yourself and don't care about the society and the whole structure, the structure will crumble. And 700 years ago, half of the two outer walls fell to the ground, and it will never be rebuilt. Now, this is what the Jews invested in. The Romans invested in stone and gold and material. And the Jews, and then later on the Christians, invested in text, words, ideas, ethics, spirituality. And one other thing, we invested in our children. Now, the Romans could not understand the Jews, and then later on the Christians. When a baby was born in pagan Rome, the wife would have the baby in a room only with women. The father would stand outside, probably watching footing on TV and smoking a cigar. And when the baby was born, the slaves would come and put it at the father's feet on the ground. Now, if it had a birth defect, he would turn his back on it. If it was one girl too many, same thing. That baby would be wrapped up and left out in the woods to be eaten or to be adopted by prostitutes to become a prostitute. Now, if the baby was a boy and was in good condition, then the father would bend down and pick it up from the floor, and this would say, now this is officially my child. And this is where we get the expression in English, raising a child. And they could not understand the Jews, that we would not kill our elderly relatives if they were disabled by age or infirmity, and that we would not kill a single child, that we kept all our children. So we have the difference of the investment. Now, we know from the Talmud, when you study Talmud, you do not think A, B, C, D, E. It is non-linear thinking. It's like this and like this. And this is what attracted the artists and the engineers and the architects to this kind of thought down through the ages. This is one of the earliest schools of Kabbalistic thought in the world. This is the Merkava, the divine cart or wagon. And in the vision of Ezekiel, he's way down here. You can barely see him. This is by the great artist Raphael in the 1500s. He went through Florence and got exposed to Jewish wisdom literature, and he loved it, and he would put it in his paintings. So this is just the vision of Ezekiel, but he puts in the four chayot, the four creatures that are holding up God's chariot. So you've got the eagle, the angel, the lion, and the bull. And Christianity takes over these Kabbalistic symbols, and they become the symbols of the four writers of the Gospels, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. So we already have Kabbalistic thought getting transformed into the Christian texts. But here he's hiding the fact that many people were meditating on the Merkava. Now, there's another thought in the first layers, let's say, of Kabbalah, of the human soul divided into the inclination to do good, Yetzer Tov, and the inclination to do evil, Yetzer Ra. And these two sort of do arm wrestling for the rest of our lives inside our hearts. Now, it's chicken and the egg. Did we get this from Plato, or did Plato get this from us? Many people say that the original writings are ahead of Plato by about 100 years. Now, Plato talks about the Kabbalistic idea of Yetzer Ra and Yetzer Tov in his book Phaedra. And he talks about the human soul in a mystical carriage, a mystical wagon, and there are two horses, flying horses. One is tame and goes straight ahead on the good path. The other is wild, animalistic, impulsive, and can't be tamed, and is uncontrollable, wants to just run off in all directions. Now, a later artist in Rome said, cool, I'm going to hide that. This was all completely forbidden to study or talk about in Rome under the Inquisition. He belonged to a secret organization called the Arcadians. This is the 1700s in Rome. He was asked to finish off a fountain after the original designer died, and he did it. And now there is a giant symbol of Kabbalah, of the symbol of Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Ra from the Kabbalah and from Plato in the middle of Rome. I don't know if you'll recognize this fountain. It's Trevi. It is the number one most photographed fountain in the world, one of the five top photographed objects in the entire world. Millions of people every year, and nobody knew that you've got Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Ra right there in the middle of the fountain. And sure enough, I researched it, and he was in the secret group in Rome. They were pretending to study pastoral poetry, and they were all studying Kabbalah and Platonic thought. A lot of them got in a lot of trouble. Now, I'm jumping around here because this normally can go for about between 3 hours or a semester in university. So to do this all in a few minutes, we're going to get a taste. I'm just scratching the surface. After the Protestant army of the Lanzichenecchi raided Rome and ripped it to shreds in the year 1527, the Pope fled for his life. The Pope was a friend of Michelangelo. He was also raised in the house of the de' Medici. He was a de' Medici. He was exposed to Kabbalah. So he brings an artist and architect, Antonio Sangallo the Younger, and he says, I have to flee Rome, and there's a mountaintop fortress that's the most defensible place around Rome. So he moves the whole government there. And he said, we need fresh water. We need a well. But I want it to be something that's going to protect me, not just physically, but also spiritually. So this architect, who knows the Kabbalah, like Michelangelo, they were friends, he constructs this well. It's very strange because it's got an Irish name. This is St. Patrick's Well in the middle of Italy. But that's not the real name. The real name is his Purgatorio, which means a place to do to atone for your sins, to cleanse your soul. Now, when the Israelites leave Egypt, one of the places where they stop is a place called Elim, and there are 70 palm trees and 12 springs, and it's a place of abundance and safety. So the architect reads that, and he makes it. This is one of the most incredible engineering feats of the entire Renaissance. And there are 70 windows, there are 12 levels, and there are 6 columns. This is all Kabbalistic numerology, gematria. Now, by the way, in Kabbalah, the positive commandments, and this is also basic traditional Judaism, the positive commandments are 248. And you want to guess how many steps there are to do your meditation to get all the way down to the bottom? 248. It's to do total meditation, cleanse your soul. In Kabbalah, we say within the descent, we find the ascent. And that's what we have here. You descend down to the bottom, meditating, trying to be aware and confess your sins. It's sort of like spiritual house cleaning. It's like doing Yom Kippur in about an hour. And you come to the bottom and you look up. And if you're in the right place, right at the well, it's a 6-pointed light that you look up to. And then you start your ascent. Kabbalah in architecture in the middle of the 1500s. Now this is a very rare photo. This is inside. It's a shame that the colors aren't good in this. But this is more like a rainbow or a peacock. This is the amazing cupola or dome of the Great Synagogue of Rome. This was an engineering marvel in its day. This is 1904, this is dedicated. This is the first dome in Rome that's entirely made out of aluminium. And it's got, of course, a mystical message to make sure that the Jews would survive forever in Rome. You've got two kinds of trees. You've got the date palm tree, the tamar, and you've got the cedar, or erez, of Lebanon. Now, why is that? During the week, we say the prayer that's inscribed in a circle around the sanctuary, God rules, God ruled, God will always rule. And then on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, the seventh day of completion, we have the rainbow with its 7 colors. And in the 92nd Psalm for the Sabbath, it says, the righteous shall grow like a date palm or like the cedar of Lebanon. And mystically, any community of any religion needs two kinds of tzaddikim, of righteous people. You need the one who is an example by scholarship, by study, by piety, by prayer, not necessarily a sociable person, not a people person, but somebody who sets the example. And that's the cedar of Lebanon. The cedars of Lebanon spread out and they stand alone, one by one. Then you need the social one, the one who's in the community, setting up soup kitchens, taking care of the elderly, the orphans, the sick, and doing community work. And that is the date palm tree that always grow in groves and give fruit and shade. And if you have both the cedar of Lebanon and the date palm, your community will always survive and thrive if you have both these kinds of righteousness. And that's a secret message hidden in this dome from 1904. Now, speaking of things elevated, this is by Raphael right over the sleeping cot of Pope Julius II, who was il Papa Terribile, the scary pope, the frightening, violent pope. And he was already elderly and sick when he becomes pope. And next to his, what we would call the Oval Office in America, the papal office for signing all his most important documents and having private ceremonies for government and things like that, he had a little resting room. And he would go in next to a nice fireplace. It's all still there. And there was, used to be, his little reclining cot where he could take a nap. Now, he wanted something over his head. So Raphael makes an artificial tent. You see the little nails holding what looks like cloth over his head. This is all an optical illusion. It's just frescoes. It's plaster and paint. But it looks like little pieces of fabric stretched out over his head, like a tent of peace. And he has four times that God helps humanity, all of them from the Jewish Bible and the Kabbalah, nothing from the Christian or Catholic tradition. Now, here, we've got God releasing Noah and his family from the ark after the flood has passed with watery angels. Over here, we've got the binding of Isaac with an angel in the air stopping Abraham from sacrificing his son Isaac. Lying on the ground, we have Jacob dreaming of the ladder with angels coming down to the earth and coming back up. Again, the symbol of spiritualizing the earth. And I'm not gonna make you break your necks. Look, such service we have here. Look at that, you don't have to do this. This is the last one. God appearing in the burning bush with fiery angels to Moses the shepherd. So what does this have to do with Kabbalistic secrets? Well, in Kabbalistic prayer, when you go to bed or go to sleep, you ask four archangels to watch over you. You have Gabriel, you have Uriel, Raphael, and Michael, and over your head, at your feet, and at your sides to protect you while you're asleep. And they relate to the four elements. What are the four elements of the world in this thinking back then?
Air, water, fire, and earth.
Thank you. Air, water, fire, and earth. So here we've got the archangels from the Kabbalah of, where's the Arcada? Air, water, fire, and earth. So we have the four Kabbalistic archangels protecting the Pope inside the Vatican Palace, thanks to Raphael. Speaking of the Vatican, this is a very rare and unknown design. This is by Bernini. This is his original proposal for St. Peter's. I can't call it St. Peter's Square because it's round. So it's St. Peter's Piazza. And most people don't know that it was going to be a complete circle with just two little lanes for carriages to come in. And then this got X'd. Why? He decided he wanted something more powerful. This is what St. Peter's Piazza looks like today. There are 248 columns. What's that from? You're smiling. What is it?
The number of positive mitzvot.
It's the number of the positive mitzvot. And he's saying, here's all the positive mitzvot to surround you. And that's just one of the many, many Kabbalistic secrets hidden inside the main piazza of the Vatican itself. Now, this is not conjecture. The number one Christian Kabbalistic expert in the 1600s, was a German Jesuit, Athanasius Kircher, and he was the special Kabbalistic advisor on all construction in Papal Rome in the 1600s. Bernini and his rival Borromini all put Kabbalah in their works under the advice and orders from the Kabbalistic advisor to the popes. Now, there were some people, there were some people back then who were very, very concerned about the growing malchut of the Vatican, the earthly, material, non-spiritual power of the Vatican, called the Papal States. These were military occupied zones. And these were going on for centuries, and they were oppressing and suppressing the Italians up and down the boot. Now, one man started off really like this with the Vatican. He was raised personally by a pope, and then the relationship went really bad. His name is Frederick II, the great emperor. He was called the astonishment of the world in Latin. Now, he went to Jerusalem. He got in a lot of trouble because he made peace with the Muslims. He spoke perfect Arabic. He also studied Judaism and Hebrew. He wanted to know all the different traditions, and he made peace with the head of the Muslims, and he got back Jerusalem. They gave back Jerusalem to the Western world, but without shedding any blood. And the Vatican actually excommunicated him because they wanted a massacre at the time. I'm not talking about the Vatican today. I'm talking about the Vatican 8 centuries ago. It's a big difference, obviously. So he comes back to Italy, and the Vatican declares war on him. He also loves one section of Italy. Anybody ever been to Abruzzo? He loved Abruzzo, and he also wanted to hem in the growing material and warlike power of the Vatican. So he measured, he had his engineers measure Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem in the 1200s, when Frederick was there and negotiated for its liberation. He found out it was about 750 meters above sea level, with this shape and 12 gates. Let's turn it around, and you can see it's more of a diamond shape here. Now, he wanted to put a copy of Jerusalem inside Italy to block the growing military and material power of the Vatican in its day. So he turned Jerusalem this way, facing down towards the Vatican, and had this blocking the power of the Vatican so it couldn't enter his beloved region of Abruzzo. He did it. He found an open plain, the exact same height as Jerusalem, and he founded a brand new city where there was nothing. He named it with one of the nicknames for the Messiah in Kabbalah, the eagle, Nesha, and in Italian that's Aquila. And the town of Aquila is just like very close to, let's spin that, there we go, to Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem in the time of Frederick, and this is Aquila that he builds in the middle of the 1200s, and there's where he puts the holiest part of the city to block the growing material power of the Vatican. The Vatican never conquered Abruzzo, by the way. There's so many secrets here. Bernini, after he'd made St. Peter's Piazza, was ordered to put a statue in front of this very important church, which was the head of the Inquisition. He hated the Inquisition. Their main building was right there, where they put Galileo on trial. And he made, in front of it, this beautiful baby elephant, which all the kids in Rome still love. Now, there's two rules when you put a statue in front of the front door of a major basilica, a Catholic church. The figure, human or animal, must bow and smile to the front door. At the last minute, he sends a message to his head assistant, Ercole, and he says, spin the statue 180 degrees. The next day in 1687, when they unveil the statue, all the kids love it, but the day after, the head of the Holy Inquisition looks out his window in the morning, and this is what greets him. It's squeezing its little tush, the sphincter is opening up, the tail's out of the way, he's going to shoot a missile of greeting right through the window of the Holy Inquisition. He lets out a scream you could hear all over Rome. He sends a formal protest in Latin to the Pope. The Pope, who's a childhood friend of Bernini, according to tradition, he sends a message to Bernini saying, they got our message, let's go for drinks. And they left the statue there to show who's really in charge. And the Dominicans, the whole Holy Inquisition, abandoned the building. The baby elephant won, the Inquisition lost. We could go on and on and on. Churches in Rome. Churches in the north. This is all about da'at, hoarding up wisdom. Chokhmah, spiritual illumination. The symbol of spiritual illumination in Kabbalah is the lightning bolt like Eureka. Sudden inspiration, and also the menorah, the central candle, the central flame here is the sign of spiritual eureka, spiritual wisdom. The menorah was brought to Rome. I wish I had a few hours to tell you about all the vicissitudes of the menorah, all the clues we have. This is by Raphael inside the Vatican, and here he gets the holy priest, the high priest wrong, the holy Torah wrong, the holy temple wrong. The one thing he gets right are the objects and the menorah. How he gets that right? Who knows? In all Catholic churches, there's a copy of Chokhmah, divine wisdom, over the middle flame. Three candles. And where we would put the middle flame, there's the cross or a crucifix. Here you have, in St. Peter's itself, a menorah hidden in the design of the head altar of the Pope with the light of the Holy Spirit for the light of Jewish Kabbalistic Chokhmah, again making a bridge between the two faiths. Okay, that's my time, or it's windy outside. This is the site of the original Jewish cemetery of Rome. When they moved the cemetery to put in a rose garden in the 1950s, all the pathways through the rose garden became a giant menorah. Some of it's overgrown now, but they made sure to have the central flame of Chokhmah. And on and on and on. I told this the other day about the Parliament of Italy, and it is illuminated by a giant menorah entering the building to illuminate the Italian politicians with spiritual enlightenment. Whenever I show this in Italy, all the audiences tell me it hasn't worked yet. So that's just a quick trip through some of the Kabbalistic things. To this day, Kabbalah, Talmud, Judaism, and other faiths are trying to transform the world from material to spiritual. We're in a building dedicated to business, but even in business, if you want to build something lasting, you know this better than I do. If it's not based on ethics, goodwill, and spirituality, it's not going to stand. It'll be like the Colosseum. It'll crumble and be a ruin. Today, we still invest in our children. We still invest in what we feel is right in the world. And if anything carries on the message of spirituality and Kabbalah in art and architecture and engineering, it's that. And I applaud you, all of you, in your efforts to continue investing in business in a spiritual and ethical way. Thank you for listening.
Well, on behalf of JBD, I'd like to thank firstly Wingate Group for hosting today, and Roy for a fascinating insight into things we never even knew were there, but were right in front of our faces. We're running a bit late, so we've got time for one question. Anybody? Don't shout at once.
Just wondering how much do you think the Jews of Rome at the time, during all this period, actually knew what was going on and realized?
Is the symbols? That's a very good question. Today, almost nobody. But back then, there would be a lot of advisors. For instance, one of the great Talmudic commentators was Sforno. He's also a Kabbalist. And Pope Sistus V, who was the Pope during the lifetime of Sforno in the late 1500s, would put him together with, he would have him come to the Vatican and talk about Talmud and Kabbalah. So, of course, if Sforno knew, the whole ghetto knew. In the ghetto in Rome, we say one person sneezes, 100 say Gesundheit. So, there were times when a lot of people knew a lot of what was going on, other times no. Now in the modern world, no. In fact, I know because I lecture all over Italy, and the Jewish communities all over Italy can't wait to read these books, because for them, they tell me it's a lot of new information. People who are on the inside, who were advising the artists and engineers and architects, of course, they did know. They're the ones telling what to hide. Another quick question, anybody?
How do you know what comes first, let's say the Platonic thing versus the Kabbalistic thing that you mentioned, the two horses?
Yeah, it's chicken and the egg.
Is that a shared tradition, or is one influencing the other? How do you work it out?
We're not sure, because, of course, Ezekiel is before Plato, but Plato, his writings about the horses, that predates any manuscripts we have about that subject in Kabbalah. So was it just an oral tradition that he finally wrote down in Greek, or did we start our tradition of writing about it after reading his Greek philosophy? It's still a question mark because it's so close in history. If you think just a difference of 100 years, that's like a drop in the ocean of history. Other things, we do know what preceded what. Usually it's the Kabbalah preceding because it's just so ancient. Another quick question, anybody? Satisfied? Okay, good.
Okay. Please join me in thanking Roy for an amazing presentation.